The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article is entitled, Treating Heart Attacks, Changes from Eisenhower's Era to the Present Day. This comes from the Harvard Heart Letter. In the 1950s, doctors offered mainly morphine and bed rest, a far cry from the many procedures and medications provided today. During a round of golf one autumn afternoon in 1955, President Dwight Eisenhower experienced what he assumed was indigestion. After he awoke at 2 a.m. the following morning with severe chest pain, his personal physician administered several shots of morphine. It wasn't until 1 p.m. that afternoon that an electrocardiogram revealed that the president had experienced a heart attack. Cardiologist Dr. Thomas Lee, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, detailed Eisenhower's experience in the October 29, 2020 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. His piece focuses mainly on how Eisenhower's cardiologist, Paul Dudley White, communicated the event to the public. As Dr. Lee wrote, heart attacks became less mysterious and frightening to millions of Americans that day. Eisenhower's treatment also reveals the stark contrast with how doctors approach heart disease today, some 65 years later. It's amazing how much cardiovascular medicine has progressed during the lifetimes of people who are still walking around today, says Dr. Lee, former editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. Highlights of these advances include better procedures, medications, and targeted advice about lifestyle habits. A shocking reality. The hospital experience also has changed quite a bit. In the 1950s, heart patients were placed in beds throughout the hospital, away from nurses' stations where it was quieter and therefore easier to get some rest. There weren't any bedside monitors because there was no point. There wasn't anything doctors could do, says Dr. Lee. It wasn't unusual for patients to be discovered dead in their beds, presumably after developing an irregular heart rhythm. Damage from a heart attack sometimes caused the heart's lower chambers or ventricles to quiver rapidly and irregularly. Known as ventricular fibrillation, this aberration can lead to sudden cardiac arrest when the heart abruptly stops beating. Devices that deliver an electric shock to restore the heart's normal rhythm, called defibrillators, didn't come along until the late 1950s. The portable versions, automated external defibrillators, arrived on the scene in the late 1970s. They're now found in shopping malls, offices, airports, and other public places. The first implantable cardioverter defibrillator, or ICD, a miniature version that's placed under the skin below the collarbone, followed soon after in 1980. If someone has a cardiac arrest, a bystander can push hard and fast on the person's chest to keep the blood flowing to the brain until a defibrillator can be used. This technique, called cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, was developed in 1960. Pardon me, I had to switch the page here. The 1960s also ushered in the concept of the hospital coronary care unit. Heart patients were grouped together where they could receive continuous heart rhythm monitoring, CPR, and defibrillation. Together, these advances halved the number of deaths in hospitalized heart attack patients. Meanwhile, surgeons were advancing procedures to fix narrowed or blocked coronary arteries, the root cause of most heart attacks. The first coronary artery bypass surgery was performed in 1960. A less invasive alternative, angioplasty, was first done on a coronary artery in 1977. The tiny mesh tubes called stents that prop open arteries during angioplasty was introduced a decade later. Soon after his heart attack, Eisenhower received the clot-preventing medications warfarin and heparin. Although still used today in certain settings, these drugs have largely been replaced by newer, safer anti-clotting drugs developed in recent decades. But for slashing heart-related deaths, Dr. Lee gives the most credit to two other classes of drugs. One is beta blockers, first developed in 1962, which slow the heart rate and lower the blood pressure. The other is the group of cholesterol-lowering drugs known as statins, first described in 1976. Like 57% of American men in 1955, Eisenhower smoked cigarettes. At the time of his heart attack, age 62, he was smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day. It wasn't until 1960 that the landmark Framingham Heart Study reported that cigarette smoking increased the risk of heart disease. Today, only just under 14% of Americans smoke, and experts recently confirmed that even a single daily cigarette increases your risk. The experience of another president, Bill Clinton, offers some useful lessons. Clinton had high cholesterol but stopped taking his statin. Dr. Lee notes, that likely contributed to the progression of his heart disease, which eventually required a quadruple bypass in 2004 when he was 58 years old. After that, he went on mainly a plant-based diet. He's done a great job of cleaning up his lifestyle, and I think a lot of people were inspired to eat better as a result, says Dr. Lee. Remember these two tips. Don't brush off chest pain, assuming it's indigestion, and stay on your statin drug, if you're taking one. But don't be too hard on yourself. Even the President of the United States can be susceptible to wishful thinking, Dr. Lee says. And there's two short related articles. The first is entitled The Framingham Heart Study. In 1948, the Framingham Heart Study recruited 5,209 men and women aged 30 to 62 living in a town just west of Boston. Careful monitoring of these volunteers enabled researchers to identify the major contributors to cardiovascular disease, which they dubbed risk factors. In addition to identifying smoking as one such risk factor in 1960, other key lifestyle findings reported in 1967 were that physical activity lowers the risk of heart disease, and obesity increases the risk. Evidence that psychosocial factors like stress and anger could affect cardiovascular risk was published in 1978. The study also provided a wealth of other information about the roles of cholesterol, blood pressure, age, sex, and genetics. In 1971, the study began enrolling additional cohorts, including the children and grandchildren of the original group, as well as 2 new groups of racially diverse participants. Another related article is entitled Bananas. Bananas are one of the most popular fruits in the United States, perhaps because they're affordable at about 58 cents per pound and available year-round. Bananas are one of the best sources of potassium, with about 450 milligrams per banana. Healthy adults not on certain medications should aim for 4,700 milligrams of potassium daily, although few Americans meet this goal. A high potassium intake may help reduce high blood pressure and has also been linked to a lower risk of stroke and possibly of heart disease. Bananas make great snacks since they're naturally prepackaged and fairly filling. They're also good sliced on cold or hot cereal or a peanut butter sandwich and make a great addition to a fruit smoothie. You can also make a creamy ice cream-like dessert by freezing sliced bananas for 2 hours, then pureeing them in a food processor until they're smooth. For a flavor boost, add cocoa powder, almond or peanut butter, or cinnamon alone or in any combination. The closely related plantain, often sold near bananas in grocery stores, is another fruit worth adding to your menu. They're more starchy and less sweet than bananas, and are eaten cooked instead of raw. Select plantains that are yellow with black spots, or mostly black, peel, slice, and pan fry to serve them alongside black beans for a Caribbean-inspired meal. Our next section is called Ask the Doctor with Deepak L. Bhatt, the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. The first question is, what is heart rate variability? In last month's Heart Letter, you described some of the ways your heart rate reflects your health. But I've also heard about another measurement called heart rate variability. Can you explain what that's all about? Heart rate variability is a sophisticated measurement of the variation in time between each heartbeat. We know that a heart rate that's too slow, too fast, or irregular can signal a problem. It's only natural to think that a steady, regular pulse is a sign of a healthy heart. And you might also assume that having little or no difference in the time between each beat is best, and that would be called low heart rate variability. But the opposite is actually true. A high variable heartbeat means that the interval between heartbeats fluctuates, although only by a fraction of a second. For example, if your heart rate is 60 beats per minute, instead of 1 second between beats, you'd have 0.8 seconds between some beats and 1.2 seconds between others. According to several studies, high heart rate variability, or HRV, seems to signal a healthy heart because it reflects the heart's ability to respond quickly to rapid changes occurring throughout the body. Heart rate variability is actually a reflection of your autonomic nervous system rather than your heart. The primitive part of your nervous system works on autopilot, regulating your heart rate, breathing, blood pressure, and digestion. There are two parts. One governs the stress or fight or flight response. The other controls the relaxation, rest, and recovery response. In a healthy person, HRV should increase when your heart rate drops, as it does during relaxing activities like reading or meditating. HRV decreases as the heart rate rises, such as when you exercise or are under stress. In fact, it changes constantly both through the day and from day to day. But chronic stress, poor sleep, lack of exercise, and an unhealthy diet can disrupt the balance, and your fight or flight system can shift into overdrive. Perhaps not surprisingly, low HRV is associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. People with high HRV, on the other hand, tend to have higher fitness levels and be more resilient to stress. However, there isn't a recommended HRV value because it varies widely, depending on your age, sex, fitness level, medical history, and genetics. Many smartwatches and wearable health monitors feature programs that measure HRV, though it's not clear just how accurate or reliable these readings are. But for some people, tracking their HRV may motivate them to make healthy lifestyle changes. In general, the greater your degree of physical fitness, the more variable your heart rate is. Our next article from the February 2021 Harvard Heart Letter is called "Put a Song in Your Heart." Listening to music may offer a range of benefits for cardiovascular health. Music's capacity to evoke emotion is one reason people love listening to it so much. Whether you want to feel energized and uplifted, or calm and relaxed, you can probably conjure a few examples of melodies that put you in your desired frame of mind. As it turns out, those mood-related benefits may extend to your heart. The beating of your heart and your fight-or-flight system are regulated by your brain. Once you understand that, it makes sense that listening to music that evokes a certain mood might affect the heart's function, says Dr. Andrew Budson, a lecturer on neurology at Harvard Medical School and chief of cognitive and behavioral neurology at the VA Boston Healthcare System. Tuning into music's feel-good vibes can have positive effects on several factors related to cardiovascular health. For example, listening to music both before or during exercise can boost your stamina and make your workout more enjoyable, according to a review article in the February 2020 Psychological Bulletin. Researchers pooled results from 139 studies looking at music's role in exercise and sport dating back more than a century. The earliest known publication from 1911 documented faster speeds in a bicycle race when a band played than when the band was silent. Music may help distract you from the unpleasant sensations you may feel when you're exercising hard and getting tired. That may explain why listening to music seems to lower your level of perceived exertion, or how hard you feel your body is working. The magnitude of music's benefit is modest, the authors conclude, but just like with exercise, every little bit counts. And getting regular exercise is a great way to improve your heart health. Some research suggests that listening to music with a fast tempo, 170 to 190 beats per minute, or BPM, helps keep your heart rate up and lowers your perceived exertion more than music with a tempo that's medium, 130 to 150 BPM, or slow, 90 to 110 BPM. But simply choosing music you enjoy to accompany your workout makes the most sense, says Dr. Budson. For other heart-related maneuvers, the right tempo can be vital. Diminishing pain and anxiety. Other research suggests that listening to music may help people cope with pain from heart-related procedures. In a review published May 29, 2020, in Pain Medicine, researchers looked at 14 studies on the effects of listening to music after and sometimes during heart procedures or surgeries. The type of music varied, including classical, jazz, and folk music, among other forms, but most were relaxing and soft. The authors concluded that music seems to help reduce pain. It may also slow breathing rate and lower systolic blood pressure. Cardiologists at many medical centers, including Harvard's teaching hospitals, allow patients to listen to their choice of music during cardiac catheterizations, in which a doctor threads a catheter through an artery in the groin up to the heart. During these procedures, people are under conscious sedation, meaning they receive medication to make them relaxed and sleepy, and to relieve pain. One small study found that listening to self-selected music for 20 minutes prior to a cardiac catheterization helps ease anxiety and pain so that people require less medication during the procedure. Increasingly, pain medication experts are concentrating less on fighting pain and more on distracting people from pain by focusing on other things. Music can provide that pleasant distraction, says Dr. Budson. A short related article is entitled, A Life-Saving Soundtrack. Anyone who's taken a cardiopulmonary resuscitation class knows that the disco classic Staying Alive provides the right rhythm for this life-saving maneuver. Clocking in at 103 beats per minute, the song fits within the ideal range for doing chest compressions, which is between 100 and 120 beats per minute. But if you're not a fan of disco, many other songs fill the bill, like Work It by Missy Elliott, What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, and Achy Breaky Heart by Billy Ray Cyrus. However, you should always call 911 if you think someone needs CPR, or if you put your phone on speaker, the operator can coach you through the steps, including counting the pace of the chest compressions. Our next article from the Harvard Heart Letter of February 2021 is called Migraine, a Connection to Cardiovascular Disease. About 1 in 6 adults in the United States report having migraines, but these debilitating headaches are 3 times more prevalent in women. During a migraine attack, people often feel nauseated and are sensitive to light and sound. Up to a third of migraineurs experience odd visual or physical sensation called auras. Usually the aura occurs soon before the headache, although some people experience just the aura without the headache. Both versions are known as migraine with aura or classic migraine, and both have long been linked to an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, especially stroke. But migraine sufferers should interpret this risk in context, says Dr. Christopher Anderson, chief of stroke and cerebrovascular disease at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Migraines tend to be most common in younger women, and their baseline risk of stroke is quite low in the first place, Dr. Anderson explains. The latest evidence comes from a 2020 study in JAMA of nearly 28,000 women who were part of the Women's Health Study. All were age 45 or older and had no evidence of cardiovascular disease when the study began in the early 1990s. Researchers tracked the women's health until 2018. Just 5% of the participants reported having migraine with aura. Their annual rate of heart attack, stroke, or death from cardiovascular disease was slightly higher, 3.4 per 1,000 women, than the rate among women who had migraines without aura or no migraines, 2.1 per 1,000 women. Experts aren't exactly sure what's behind this observation, but one theory points to a shared underlying mechanism. Migraines are thought to result from unusual patterns of electrical activity in the brain, caused by sweeping waves of neurons firing and then turning off. A migraine aura may be a manifestation of this phenomenon, which doctors referred to as cortical spreading depression. It may reflect some sort of blood vessel instability that also makes people more prone to cardiovascular issues, says Dr. Anderson. If you get migraines with aura, there aren't any specific steps you can take to limit your cardiovascular risk, but women who are 35 and older who have migraine with aura should be sure to tell their primary care provider or gynecologist about their headaches. Taking estrogen-containing birth control pills or hormone therapy may further raise stroke risk. As a result, they might want to consider other non-hormonal or estrogen-free treatment options. We don't necessarily want to dissuade women from taking hormone medicines, as the risk and benefit calculation is different for everyone, says Dr. Anderson. Just make sure all of your doctors are aware of all your health conditions and current medications. Auras don't occur before every migraine, but once you've had one, you're considered to have classic migraine. In adulthood, people typically do not develop new symptoms during future migraines. Most people seem to have their own particular predictable versions of these headaches. So if you experience a new symptom, don't dismiss it, says Dr. Anderson. For example, if your typical aura consists of flashes of light, but you start to experience numbness or weakness in your hand, it could be something other than a migraine, he cautions. Seek emergency care as soon as possible. The article points out that a migraine aura refers to a visual or sensory disturbance that strikes within the hour before the headache takes hold. The vision changes often include a blind spot called a scotoma that affects both eyes but just one side of the visual field. Although scotomas usually appear black in people with other conditions, in migraines they're usually white or gray, and they look like a shimmering or scintillating zigzag in the shape of a crescent that expands across one side of the visual field and then moves off into the peripheral vision. One common variant is called fortification spectrum because the pattern of bright geometrical lines resembles the walls of a medieval fort. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.com. .org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I hope you enjoyed it.